We are with Michael Plischka, president of Zen Storming. Michael has worked for over 18 years in the healthcare industry, working with clinicians and patients to design and develop better products and services. He has won multiple corporate awards and has over 20 patents issued and pending in the United States as well as internationally. 5 years ago, he founded Zen Storming Solutions, a creativity, innovation, and design consultancy. He continues to design products, but also provides training to help people and companies be more creative and make a difference. He strongly believes in co-design methodologies, sharing design thinking essentials, empowering people to design. He is a board member of Asset Builders Community Development Corporation, dedicated to helping the financially disadvantaged become self-sufficient. He has also spearheaded an interreligious dialogue between his faith community and the local Muslim community. He has a Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical Engineering and a Master of Arts in Theology and Spirituality. He also dabbles as a musician, artist, poet, bonsai crafter, hockey goalie, luger, we'll get back to that one in a moment, fencer, fisherman, and fearless cook. Now, there are many people that are in the music world that are fencers, including Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden, who has told me that it helps him stay focused and relaxed. There are musicians who have picked up drumming that helps them with their timing. Before we really get into how bonsai crafting and being a fisherman and a fearless cook can help alter one's life and enable co-creation, why don't you explain what co-creation is in your terms?
Sure, Stephen. Co-creation is the process by which people work together to create new destinies, new conditions, new situations. It's basically working together to move forward, as opposed to simply giving somebody something or designing something or making something in a strictly deliverable type of context. And what I mean by that is, typically in the past, what's happened is people come up and you know, companies and organizations, they look at a certain group of people and they say, okay, what are we going to make for you? And what is it that you need? What is it that you think you need? And then what they do is they go back into their little rooms and they create something and then deliver it back to those people and say, here you go, and either sell it to them or give it to them, whatever the case is. Co-creation is something that's radically different in that you're now using the input of those people, but in a very cooperative manner. And there's a little co prefix again. You're working with them to understand not just what they're saying, but you really want to get at those latent needs and what is it that those people really, really want that's within their context. And they actually become part of the conversation, and they're the ones that are actually doing the creating along with the for lack of a better word, the moderator or the facilitator of the entire process.
Now, the idea of co-creation is not a new one, but why is it, what's the stumbling block for many people and corporations in using that as an application to enable something?
It's a great question. I think that one of the main reason it becomes a stumbling block is because of the fact that it is relinquishing control, for one. I think that's the biggie. There's a sense there that you're no longer the one that's dictating your destiny. If you're a company or an organization, you're looking and you're saying, I'm willing to let these other people speak and say their minds, and more importantly, speak their hearts. Let their desires and their emotions come forward and become something better and bigger. And when that happens, companies and organizations in general like to have their fingers on in how everything is working. And in general, the bigger the company, the more they want that control, and the less they feel comfortable with any types of changes. So that's the biggest stumbling block, is essentially that you're no longer in control. And the other stumbling block, and it's a little bit not quite as large of a stumbling block, but it's the issue that it takes time, and you need to sit down, and you truly need to be able to listen to people and work with people and understand where people are at. And it's
what takes time now?
This would be the main part about taking time is culturing or cultivating the relationships and working together with people. It's like any friendship. When you work together with somebody as a friend and you become a friend with somebody, it takes time to be able to truly know that person and understand where that person's at, to that point where when you ask them, hey, how you doing? And they come back to you and say, so-so. And you can tell where they're coming from just by their voice, by their inflection, by how they're responding to you. It's the same thing in the co-creation process, ultimately. It takes time to be able to understand and truly work with people and be patient enough to understand where they're coming from and building that level of trust in both directions, as well as building the rapport so that you can go forward and work together and create something together.
Well, let me ask you a question regarding this. How familiar are you with the open source software world?
That's actually a great example, Stephen, of one of the examples of co-creation. It's a great example. There are other examples out there. For example, Lego is the Lego building blocks on their webpage. They have various types of tools that enable kids and parents to design their own products and then bring those to fruition. And that's something that's not just for the kids, it's for everybody. The open source software is a great example because it truly democratizes much of the software development processes, as well as where the software goes. And it really, really creates a vibrant
community.
A vibrant community. And it's actually a very formidable weapon is too strong of a word, perhaps, but it's something that businesses have to grapple with one way or another. And I'm glad you actually brought up open source software, because in a way, that's actually a stumbling block as well, especially to companies, because open source right away precludes any type of ownership. And
with an there is an exception, if I might can
sure.
add. A conversation I had with a gentleman who runs Linux International, John Mad Dog Hall, who's like one step away from if I pronounce his name improperly, my apologies, but not Linus Torvaldser, who is the inventor and creator of the Linux operating system. And we were talking about the idea that open source technology and community collaboration is the future, and a lot of people don't understand it because they don't understand how to monetize.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the power is taken away from the company or the organization, what if the actual power was given to the co-creators to own it, what they add to the kernel of the idea?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Couldn't co-creation be the future of music creation and collaboration and the future for promotion pictures?
Oh, most definitely. I totally concur with you, Stephen. I think that there's definitely a future there. As a matter of fact, earlier in the year, I was performing as part of with some colleagues for a CD launch party that my colleague was doing, and interestingly enough, his particular project that he was promoting was actually with an artist who was based in France, and they had co-created between just the two of them, although obviously the field could get much larger. He was working with them he created an entire CD and a whole project around this collaboration overseas. And up until recently when they performed live, they hadn't even seen each other in face-to-face. So most definitely the future is there with music collaboration. You've got also software out there, or projects, websites like SoundCloud and other ones where people can upload music and swap various parts of it and do mashups of music and bring things together. So it's a very exciting type of situation. And that can be kind of intimidating, though, to a lot of people because, like I said before, the ones that want the control, they don't have it. And it requires a level of cooperation, I think, that many organizations aren't comfortable with or familiar with yet.
Well, isn't the idea we add to this of open source and collaboration and cooperation? The Mozilla project, the Firefox web browser, is pretty much built on that.
Right.
And we all see how Firefox has outshone any attempts of Microsoft to stay in that bit, to have a dominance. They want to build something that works for people, so people donate their time. Now, that doesn't mean that co-creation is charitable.
Right.
How do we empower people to co-create? How can we get people to see the benefits of this?
It's a great question. The empowering is key to co-creation. And there's a couple different aspects of empowering. That first of all, when you empower somebody, what you're doing is you're eliminating fear. You're casting out the fear. You're getting rid of it so that people can actually be all that they can be. In essence, you're clearing away obstacles. And that's huge, because when obstacles are there, obviously, and people that you're working with have to be able to work freely, obviously, if anything's getting in the way of that, that's a problem. There's a step, though, that goes in front of this, so to speak, as part of empowering. And there's that old saying, Stephen, that you can't give what you don't have. And so one of the things that's really important in empowering is that you have to be empowered yourself. You have to feel empowered yourself. And that's something that you have to share where you're coming from and what you've been given. Now, that's part of that is that that means that each individual, if you're empowering, you've got to be open to your potential. You've got to be connected to yourself. And you got to realize that each person exists in the perfect time and place. They are the sum of, each person is the sum of his or her own history, his upbringing, genetics, her interactions with people. Everything about that is totally unique. And if you're not sharing of that, you're not being authentic to yourself, and you can't really empower because you're not truly grounded in who you are and what you have to bring to the table in the entire conversation here. Joseph Campbell, who is well known for his studies from in the studies of mythology, he said something that once he said the influence of a vital person vitalizes, and he said that people have the notion of saving the world by shifting things around, changing the rules, and who's on top and so forth. And he goes on and he says, any world is a valid world if it's alive. The thing to do is to bring life to it. And the only way to do that is to find your own case where the life is and become alive yourself. So that becomes like the grounding for empowering. And from that, there's a whole branch of, it brings with it enthusiasm. Now, enthusiasm is interesting because that word is from the Greek. And the Greek word enthusiasm, it actually means to be possessed by or inspired by a god, or to have a god within. And so some of the synonyms for enthusiasm are things like activity, ardor, boldness, conviction, keenness, impetuosity, verve. Those are all really powerful words for what it means to be enthusiastic. And Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, he goes, nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. And it's true. And you need that something to push you through. And that's where – that's that font, that bubbling out of energy and co-creative power that literally becomes empowered. That's what becomes shared. And Henry Ford – I'm a big guy on quotes, so that's one thing. But Henry Ford once said, enthusiasm is the yeast that makes your hopes shine to the stars. Enthusiasm is the sparkle in your eyes, the swing in your gait, the grip of your hand, the irresistible surge of will, and the energy to execute your ideas. And that key part at the end, the energy to execute your ideas, when you're co-creating and you're empowering for that, that's ultimately what you're passing on, and that's what you want to create, is a situation where you can pass along that energy to execute, and that's what's key to building the whole empowering process.
Well, how do empowerment and co-creation, what's the relationship? It's so very deeply on that.
Yeah, it's empowering is because of the fact that's you've got this base now of energy and you want to pass that on. You kind of want to connect it. There's a great quote on your website actually that says, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, is the only thing that ever has." It's from Margaret Mead. She's an anthropologist, and Massimo Banzi, who's one of the co-founders of the Arduino movement, which is, basically small programmable electronics and enabling people to make their own robots and things like that. He had a great, great thing where he said, you don't need anyone's permission to make something great. And that's very true. And when you kind of put –
How do we spell his name? Just so anyone could
– Yeah, sure. Massimo, his first name is Massimo. It's M-A-S-S. I-M-O, and his last name is Banzi, spelled B-A-N-Z-I. And if you look him up, he's given some great TED Talks, mm-hmm. and you look him up online. He's part of the Arduino movement. It's A-R-D-U-I-N-O. And the Arduino has actually become – that whole process has become the backbone for a lot of artistic installations for – building 3D, printing of 3D parts to enable people to make their own 3D products using 3D printing machineries at home and on a personal scale. The Arduino movement is a really powerful type of movement out there right now, and that is also open source. It's basically based on anybody can buy all the parts to anything. You can buy all the electronics. There's a humongous community online that enables you to download all types of software, and they will help you and be extremely helpful in building software with you. And it enables you to literally create anything you want that's got electronic components in it. And literally you can program whatever it is that you need to do. And I think it's actually a very powerful movement that hasn't risen up as quite as much yet. I think there's a localized group of people that knows about it, but I think it's a very, very strong, powerful undercurrent that will be making more inroads in the future and will make a huge impact on what people can do and what people are doing as they move forward to co-create. So having said that...
Are there any rules in co-creation? I mean, rules that are... not just based in integrity, but in seeing a project through. I mean, obviously, if a person has an idea, say they're an architect and they're designing a house,
mm-hmm.
okay, let's say, imagine anyone listening to this, they're Franklin Lloyd Wright, and they have this idea for this great building, and it becomes the Guggenheim Museum in New York City. If the architect has their own vision, doesn't the vision get corrupted if other people become part of a team to co-create, or is that just a fallacy?
I think it's a fallacy. I think that what happened – well, it's interesting that you, the way you said it, Stephen, because what can happen, I think, is if somebody comes into it, let's say the architect comes into it thinking, well, I've got the best idea in the world, and this is ultimately everything that needs to be done, and this is it, and they start getting input, and that person, if they come at it with a closed mind, and I guess that would be rule number one, if you want to put it that way, if the person that's doing the facilitating or kind of the spearheading the effort comes at it not realizing that other people can bring something to the table, then obviously that anything they see, that person will view it as a corruption of their original vision. They'll say, oh, yeah, this isn't what I had in mind. But the difference with co-creation is that it's not just about that person saying, what is it that I have in mind? It's about saying, okay, what is it that all these other people have in mind? And more importantly, what do these people have in their hearts? What are those emotions these people are feeling? What types of experiences do these people want to experience? And that's a huge part of co-creation, whereas other things were based on kind of the older creation model without the co was in essence about delivering something with features. Even if it was a service, it was something with features in it. Co-creation is different in that it enables people to put their emotions into it and create an interactivity. There's an interactivity level to it, and people are designing experiences as much as they can through what they're doing and working together. So
that let's state that whole thing you just said, that last paragraph. That I think is real, that co-creation and designing.
Yeah, co-creation is based upon the concept of getting at and enabling people to express their emotions, to create interactivity, and to create experiences. And that's in contrast to the old way of doing it, which was basically providing features to people, a product with features, and saying, here it is, this is what you get. And co-creation, on the other hand, takes a step back and gets deeper into the situation because it's actually co-designing things that are getting at the experiential and the transformational and the emotional side of things because you're truly open to what people want to contribute to the picture. And ultimately,
isn't that something like little kids playing together? Isn't there something that we're born with?
Oh, most definitely, Stephen. And
I mean, think of it, little kids. Do you have children, Michael?
I don't.
You don't have children. But you remember what it's like being a little kid, and everything is real wonderful, and anything is possible.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, we wind up, going into this life where we stop having that. Oh, don't. You're too old. You can't act that way.
Yeah. You're exactly right on, Stephen. It's amazing that's actually a great pattern for how people for how to co-create is to look at this from a standpoint of childlike play. As a matter of fact, very often some of the tools that can be used in co-creation are, in the old way, people would think in terms of focus groups or something. Again, where you give something with a bunch of features on it, and people say, oh, I like this, I don't like that. Well, when you're co-creating with somebody, you're giving them those tools to enable them to actually work with their hands and play, and that could be anything. You could use things like you give them magazines, pictures of magazines, and you could say make a board, make a mood board, make a board up with snip out the pictures that you think are apropos to what you want this process or this product to be. Things like that that bring a whole new level now of experience into the creation process. There was one time I was working with somebody, and we were looking, it was in the healthcare realm, and we were looking at trying to develop a newer type of device that would make it more easier for the nurses to do one part of their job without actually causing harm to the patient. And what I did is I brought into the meeting, I brought in a bunch of clay. And I sat down with them, and I gave them each a glob of clay, and I said, I want you to make for me what you think would work for this. And I let them go at it for a half an hour. And what was fascinating is they came up with more ideas, more really good ideas, than in that time frame than they would have if I would have just said to them, and I've been parts of these types of groups as well, where you just say, tell me what you'd like to see, or what is it that you want to see in a product, or how would you do this particular process. By just giving them clay and allowing them to play, and that's a huge word, play, they came up with all these great ideas that were really, really exciting. They were simple, and best of all, they felt like they had ownership of the process as well, and they were engaged, and everybody shared something then. It wasn't a matter of having a group where you got 10 people in a room and two people in the background, they say three words over the course of 5 hours, whereas two other guys at the front of the table, all they do is commandeer the group for the entire time. When you're giving somebody in a co-creation, when you're in a co-creation type of setting, it actually enables everybody to take part and to play in the game, so to speak. And it's just like any type of board game. It's if you sit around the board game, everybody plays. You don't have a choice. The dice comes to you, and you roll, and you play. And it's like that with co-creating as well. Everybody's at the table has a say in making what you're making.
Well, I remember when my nephew, Ruben, came over and came down to Florida with his parents, and he brought over this big jar of Legos,
mm-hmm.
and how excited he was just building stuff. And he asked me if I wanted to build something.
Hmm.
And I
That's
said,
great.
Sure, yeah. And he said, what do you want to build? I said, I don't know.
Right?
Let's just play.
Exactly. And that's such a powerful thing. And I think it's something that people forget. And a lot of organizations forget that too, especially bigger companies. They forget about the power of play. And they forget about the kind of childlike wonder that happens when you just explore. And as you alluded to this earlier, as Mefti said it, Stephen, that people are creative by nature. And a lot of times people don't think it, because they go on and say, oh, I'm not creative, because they're picturing themselves against, I'm not creative because, I can't play guitar like that guy, or I can't paint like Picasso, or I can't do this. Well, the problem is that person has pigeonholed themselves with their own definition of what creative is. But the bottom line is, each person is creative in their own way. I remember getting a bit of advice once from somebody, and I can't remember even who it was at the time, and I wish I could, because it has been valuable advice my entire life, and it's actually with regards to the music side of things. And the person said to me, and it was a situation where very often, and as a musician, this too, Stephen, sometimes you'll see somebody on stage, you'll just be blown away by them. And sometimes there's that follow-up time when you're blown away by somebody where there's a sense of smallness or insufficiency, and you think of, oh man, I'm nobody's, I have nothing to offer. And the thing is that this person said is, I can guarantee you that if that person on stage right now saw you perform and saw what you're doing, there is something that you're doing on stage, whatever it may be, and it might be something really small to you, but there is something that you're able to bring to the stage that person can't do, and that they will be amazed about in you. And
I'd like to – I'm sorry. I'm enthusiastic about what you're saying. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. That's fine. We can stop there. Go ahead.
I produced the Les Paul records, and we had our first conversation was about, we were just having a conversation. He said, Steve, you'd be an amazing producer. And I said, what? He goes, you've been producing all your life. You just didn't know it. And I told him this little story that my dad told me. Mm-hmm. And, we're not here in the story time. This is an inspirational story. George Gershwin, who is my father's favorite American contemporary composer, and also one of mine, had a moment of inferiority when he was meeting with Ravel, wrote the very famous Bolero and a lot of great music. Mm-hmm. And he said to Ravel, I wish I could play like you. I wish I could write like you. I wish I could arrange like you. And Ravel's comments to George Gershwin were as follows. Don't be a bad Ravel. be a brilliant Gershwin.
That's awesome.
And I think sometimes what happens is our own insecurities or fears get in the way of what we're really able to do. A great song is a great song no matter how it's orchestrated.
Exactly.
George Martin once told me that the Beatles would have been great without him. You know, and I mean, that's very humble in saying, but that was a let's talk some examples of co-creations that people might not even think about and look at their success. Could you provide some insights to that?
Yeah, I think that some of the co-creations, there's a lot in the it's because it's being embraced more in general by a lot of companies like Nike and some of the big names. There's a lot of things going on, but I think that where we co-create a lot more and we don't realize it, and I think this kind of brings home the whole process of co-creating, is that it does happen really often in two places I think that get underrated for being great cauldrons of creativity. And that's communities and in families. And obviously those two are connected. But there's something about, and in families, we can bring that down to a subset here, and I would say even in the kitchen. And why I say that is it's interesting. Parties at kitchens are really interesting phenomena at homes, because usually what happens is you get a group of people always hanging out in the kitchen while there's some type of cooking going on and preparation going on. And people naturally fall into place and start working together to make different things. Some people become more facilitating. They grab this, they take this, they put this, they garnish that, they fill these glasses up, they do this. They do kind of some of the more basic work, but it's work that's required, and it's part of the whole creative process of bringing together the ultimate party. And the same thing happens with cooking itself. There's different levels of that. People can, you know, people get recipes where they get a TV dinner and then they open it up and then they go in and they put their own seasonings on top of it. That's a creative act. They've just created a different dish than what it is that they opened up. There's other people that they cook and they need a recipe, and they take a recipe and they add ingredients to it while they're going, or they take away ingredients. That's a creative act right there. And when they're working together with somebody and people are putting that together, that's a co-created process. And it's the same thing when people come up and they say, okay, I'm going to whip together something brand new. And people work together and they say, okay, hey, what about if you tried this? Have you tried that in there? And they say, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. So that's something that happens all the time, and we don't even realize it. It's a creation that's going on right under our nose. Or like you said earlier, you know, when you're with your nephew, of something going on where you're playing with Legos and you're building something and you're working together. That happens on a broader level in human interaction all the time because of the fact that we're creative by nature. And I think that we have a tendency to kind of poo-poo those and push those away.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is because it's such a daily event, and because humans are so adept at it that the more benign types of creativity, if I can call them that, are viewed with less wonder and less excitement. And it's a shame because they really shouldn't be. And I think, you know, when we were talking about empowering earlier and about how important it is to have that sense of empowerment and enthusiasm about what you're doing, if you're poo-pooing all those creative parts about all those creative aspects of your life, and you say, well, I'm not creative, and you don't realize that, well, yes, you are a creative person. And when you get two or three of you people like you in a room together, that's even more powerful than just one of you in that room. But people, I think, just don't get to that level just because of the fact they've grown so accustomed to the wonder that is the human person and the ability to create and to do things. We've grown so accustomed with a baseline level of creativity that we truly don't see wonder in that as we should. And I think that that's something that we really needs to continue to be cultivated. And there's some great books about there. There's one in particular, and it's driving me nuts now because I can't remember the title of it. But the whole purpose of this book is to get people. It's like a task once a day to see the world in a different way. So you go and you journal about something, or you take a picture of something you've never taken a picture of before, or you go to a magazine rack and pick out a magazine from an area of the magazine rack that you wouldn't even have dreamt of reading from, and read from there. Doing things like that, again, just to cultivate and keep that sense of wonder alive. And I think once that gets better cultivated, then people see themselves as creative in the first place. And then from there, when everybody's working together, you get you create that environment where that magic of co-creation can happen.
You're saying keeping the sense of wonder alive. Okay. Now, while this conversation is not about me, I would like to interject something that occurred to me. When I decided I wanted to produce an event, and I claimed it as I'm producing an event to honor Les Paul, and I had just been introduced to him. Mm-hmm. And on the day I was introduced to him, he said to me, "Fine, let's go do it. Your head's in the right place. Your heart's in the right place." So an organization called ASCAP, okay, a status quo bureaucracy for songwriters, calls me up, one of the top people. And I see you're doing this event honoring Les Paul. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What gives you the right to do that? And my first initial reaction, as a knee-jerk reaction, I wouldn't do because I'm not a person who likes to inflict pain. But then I thought, and I said, give me a second. And I remember what it was like as a little boy going to Thomas Edison's laboratory in West Orange, New Jersey, and walking around and taking the tour and seeing the Black Mariah in the first movie studio and the recording studios and the labs where so much was pioneered through teams of people. And I imagined myself there, and I said to this executive, VP level at ASCAP, "No one told me I couldn't do it." He says, "What do you mean?" "I felt like doing it because it needed to be done."
That's it.
And while they had a little bit of a big attitude, it's the big attitudes of these organizations that are holding them back from going forward. And while we are at a time, a radical time of change, I really believe it's important to have co-creation places all around the world to actually take some of these ideas and make them happen, especially since it's tough to get funding for anything today. We need to co-create.
Yep.
We need to co-create ideas, inventions, innovations. So I'd like to declare that with you right now, that's one thing that we want to start doing, is enabling co-creation spaces, which we call incubators.
Yep.
Now, let's go to the process of co-creation. Is there one standard process or template of what it looks like, or is that all dependent on something else?
There is, in general, there's a certain template, if you want to call it that, and I'll use the metaphor, as we were saying before, of playing with as a child plays, and then I'll flesh it out from there. If you can imagine back what it was like to play in a sandbox, and mm-hmm. you take sand and you try and build it into a mound, and you can create kind of a smooth round mound, but there's nothing special about it. And so you take it and you put it into a bucket, and you smooth it out, you pat it down, you turn it over, and it kind of holds shape, but it kind of falls apart too. And when you turn it over and pat it into the sand. So you realize if you take some wet sand, though, and put it in the bucket and tap it down and turn it over, now it comes out and it actually keeps its shape really well. And what you've actually done is gone through the process that's used in co-creation, except you've done it on a personal level. And by that, what I mean is there's a sense of there was at first a process of understanding the problem. Well, what is it I want to do? What is, or stating the problem to yourself. What is it I want to do? What do we want to do here as a group? And that is, you want to understand and really figure out what it is that needs to be done. From there, what you do is you do need to provide common tools to people. And people are all different types of levels. So obviously, the more commonality there is to certain types of tools, and that's why I mentioned things like Legos, clay, pictures, drawing, things that everybody can partake of are really great tools to get the ball rolling with from a co-creation standpoint. You need to find common tools. And that's something that is another in the sandbox. You had the sand and you had the bucket, and everybody's got that to work with. And in some cases, there's different types of sand as well. What you do then is you say, okay, from there, you want to build, you say you want to build something, you've got the tools. Now it's a matter of kind of trying things out and experimenting. So what are different things? Well, I want to build a tower. How can I do that? Well, this bucket looks like a tower. That would be the next step. You visualize different types of solutions. You could say, I want it to be a tower. I want it to be a star shape. I want it to be, you can think of all these different things. But the bottom line is that you need to picture in your mind and you need to work together and come up with those ideas. Other people, you can call it brainstorming as well, but there's a level there of ideating and imagining what it is you want to bring to the table and what the ideal situation is going to look like. And then you try it. You try it on a small scale. And if you want to build this gigantic, massive castle that's got 10 different spires on it and you know, a drawbridge and all these different things, it's all going to start with one bucket. So you try it, like in my story, you try it with one bucket of sand, and you see how well it works. Did it work? Not really. The first time I did it, it collapsed. So you learn from that would be the next step. You learn from after trying it on a small scale. And you take those learnings, fold it back into the process, and you try again. And in this case, you add water to the sand, or you get moist sand, and then you try it again. And when it works and you finally get the result that you want, and you're seeing the results of what it is you've done, now you can do it on a larger scale. Now everybody gets a bucket. Now everybody can build the exact same way, and they can create. And some people will even improve on that. Some people realize, oh, if you put the wet sand on, and, you know, and you build with these wet sand things, you can actually stack wet sand on top of wet sand. So you can do multiple, you know, levels with this thing, or you can put things into the wet sand that'll stand up now that wouldn't stand up before. So all these people will now start contributing to the process when you start doing it on a larger scale and you kind of share these learnings from what happened. So in summary, the basic process is understanding the problem, finding the common tools that people can work with, visualizing some solutions, trying some of those solutions out, the best ones out, on a small scale first, seeing what happens, and then learning from it and folding that back into the process. And then finally, when you get what's working really well, you build on that and you continue to move forward. And that would be the basic parts of the process. On top of that, though, I would like to add that there's certain things that need to be done during that process, kind of sub-do loops, to use some programming lingo. It'd be in that you really have to allow people to have the freedom to be who they want to be. So that means that you have to come from a place of openness. You have to build on people's positives. You don't build on the negatives of people. People always think, and you see this a lot in big companies, people do their yearly reviews and they'll say to them, oh, you didn't do good on this. You didn't do good on this. Yeah, but you did great on this. I say, well, it doesn't matter. You have to improve on this or you're not getting your raise. That's not how things work. Realistically, you get your best bang for the buck from people working where their strengths are, not where they're trying to build up what's weak. And you see that in good teams all the time. In sports, you see it in the hockey. Is a great example from my own world that I like saying, is that people, not everybody is going to score 50 goals a year and do all these. Everybody's got their own talents. And sometimes one guy might be great on just, like, let's say, killing penalties or when the team has a man advantage on a power play. And because of that, the coach isn't going to say, well, you really need to work on, certain parts of your defensive capability or something if you're out there on the power play. You could. You do need some symbol of a defensive of capabilities. But when the chips are down and you're on a power play, and that means you have a man advantage and you're working in a situation where you're outmanning your opposition, each person that's on the ice needs to be playing to their strengths. They're not worried about the fact that this guy isn't the best defenseman in the world. That's not his goal job to be a defenseman. His job is to score goals. And that's something that gets overlooked in a lot of co-creative processes, or not in co-creative process, I would say in the old models. In a good co-creative process, you're always looking and you're building on the positives and you're building on strengths. And it also means you're building on each other. And to do that, you have to respect each other. And so there's a respect for other people's ideas, for where they're coming from, and you're respecting other people's histories as well, because, as I mentioned earlier, that's part of what they have to bring to the table. And it's just like your story about Gershwin. You are your best brand. You're your own brand, and you have to be the best Gershwin you can be. I have to be the best Plishka I can be, and you're the best Zuckerman. It's not a matter of me trying to be a half-baked Zuckerman. That's not going to do the world any good. And so we need to respect each other and where our own histories, and build upon that. Another thing to realize is that there's, realistically, especially in the early phases of co-creation, we can't be too quick to judge. And that means don't think of other people's ideas as bad, and don't think of our own ideas as bad. Self-judgment is really, really something that can kill a lot of creative ideas, and I see this so often. People don't even share ideas because they think it's stupid right off the bat before it even comes out of their mouth. And the problem is that very often somebody, what they would self-judge as a stupid idea, when that idea gets into the public and all of a sudden it's heard by other people around the table, other people build on that. It might not be feasible, or it might be kind of off the wall, but the point is it's a kernel, it's an inspiration that enables other people to play off it. Jazz musicians do this all the time. If jazz musicians self-judged, jazz would be really boring, and they don't. There's a level there of their trust in themselves, and what they do is they don't judge what they're going to lay out. They say, okay, here goes. And then somebody else in the band hears that, and they're like, oh, yeah, and they take it to the next level. That self-judgment can kill, and we can't subject ourselves to that. So, and I guess the final thing that goes on at the same time with this whole process is that there always needs to be space for creation. And by that, I mean that the environment, it's not about the result necessarily when you're first going, when you first get into this. It's about creating a fruitful environment. It's about enabling. It's about having the tools available that everybody can use. It needs to be about creating and having the modalities present that all the creators in the room are comfortable with and that they can work with. It's about accepting where all those people are at in their creative journeys and realizing that while some people can whip something up off the top of their heads, no problem, other people feel much more comfortable with starting at something very basic and working with somebody to bring something to fruition. That's not a bad thing. That's a great thing. Okay. And that's another thing that needs to be accepted.
Let's now give, in the last few moments of our conversation, we have about 4 or 5 left.
Yeah.
So we'll go to the next. Let's give people listening an action plan, a step-by-step action plan. Of what they can do to enable co-creation, whether it's solution enabling or inventing, what can they do?
I think that the first thing that each person can do, number one, is, again, trust in who you are. Empower yourself first before doing anything else. And that means really understand more who you are, where you're at, and go from who you are as a person and what your strengths are. don't dwell on what other people are doing or they aren't doing. Understand what you can do and start that to get the ball rolling. Second of all, find like-minded people or find like-minded situations. That could mean immersing yourself in the literature for the situation that you're in. It could mean getting on the internet and watching things. It could mean calling people, emailing people you're unfamiliar with. Somebody once said that a great practice is to find people who are CEOs of companies and get in touch with them via email or phone and try and carry on a conversation with them about an idea you have, even if they're not necessarily the right person to do it. But the goal is to get yourself out of your comfort zone and to seek out other ideas and other metaphors for your situation and other people that will help enable that situation so you can better start concretizing what you're doing. The third thing after that, then, is to literally agree on common tools. Find those things that you can use to work together with. And that might be if you're doing music, you know, you can get online and there are things that enable people to, musicians, to co-create over the web and create their own music and then bring it together. Find those tools that everybody involved in your conversation can use and everybody you've brought into this, and make sure that pool, that you know that pool well enough. And you need to understand that everybody in that pool needs to be playing from the same strengths as well. Let them, or for that same place of being strong, that's a better way to put it. So make sure they all have the right tools. And then the next thing is just go at it and start trying. Don't let yourself be inhibited, and don't censor, don't judge yourself. Don't do anything that will inhibit the process. Just start doing it. Start trying things. Let things go out there and just see what happens. It's these types of things what we see is, you know, when people talk about memes on the internet or things like that, where you just throw something to the wall and see what sticks. And if it sticks, great, build on it. If it doesn't, that's okay. Learn from it and keep moving on. Like you mentioned Edison before, he had this huge team and all these people working together doing things. And he didn't find, you know, he didn't just find, you know, he had hundreds and hundreds of patents. And he found multiple ways of doing things. Not everything he did worked, though, the way he wanted it to, and not everything was commercializable. But when he pulled together the team, worked together, tried to see what works, builds on the positives, and that would be kind of your last step and move forward. If you kind of follow those basic steps and, you know, work in that modality, then I think you'll be well on your way to really working together with people and co-creating new situations, a new environment, and ultimately a new world.
Well, this is very exciting, Michael, and I thank you for this, and I hope that everyone listening and participating will take this inspiration not just very seriously, but put it into action. And I thank you for your participation. We're going to move on to the next event shortly. Michael, if you could just hold on for a moment, that would be appreciated. And everyone else, thank you for listening, and stay tuned to the next.
Thank you.